Okay, good morning. Oh yeah, I do have chalk. I was about to get worried there. So, I have been recording the audio for the lectures. I haven't been posting it. I will start posting them today and put them all up. I'm forgetting to do that. So if I don't do that, remind me. So, the other thing is before I started things, does anyone have any questions about the assignment? That is due Wednesday late. Is that going okay? Questions easy, hard?
Not too sure.
Well, what?
Not too bad.
Not too bad.
As long as you do the exercise, yeah, a lot of it does help.
Yeah, but and you start doing those exercises then.
I mean, experience.
The experiences, yes.
Yeah.
I get mixed up here. So today, what I want to talk about is crypto. My perspective on this will not, if for those of you who have taken applied cryptography, my perspective will not be the same. But I do feel like I need to go over a couple of concepts related to it and connect it with the problems we'll be encountering in this class and in system security in general. So, crypto, you want cryptography whenever your adversary can mess with your bits. They can observe the bits, if they can change the bits, if they can, or they can kind of impersonate someone sending you bits, which is kind of an integrity thing, but it's more considered authenticity. If they can mess with the bits, then you probably need some form of cryptography. If you're talking about an isolated system, where you only have a person coming along, like interacting with it via terminal, assume the terminal is kind of directly connected in, what does crypto buy you? What does crypto buy you?
Nothing.
Almost nothing. The one thing that crypto does protect you, if you have a system that's by itself, what if someone steals the system or comes in and starts messing with the hardware, directly trying to change bits on the drive or take the drive or something like that, or they get low access to the system below the level of the operating system and mess with it, then maybe cryptography can help you. Where cryptography is normally most used is in the case where you have multiple machines and they're exchanging information. And so the crypto is on the wire. It's on the network. And so that's why you can think of why is crypto so important nowadays is because most of the time we're doing things on the network. And cryptography is the science of code. It's about how do you protect this information. When you say protect this information, I mean how do you prevent someone from changing the bits while they're being transmitted? How do you prevent someone looking at the bits? And how do you prevent someone from imitating the source, I mean, basically masquerading as someone who's sending you the bits, who they actually aren't? So that's what cryptography buys you. And anytime you look at wherever people are talking about crypto, you go like, okay, in what threat model, what sort of adversary is there, you know, someone who's going to mess with my bits? So this most classically is, you know, TLS, SSL, SSH. Those are the kind of the most common protocols now used for communication. These protocols are not simple. I will talk a bit about the building blocks of these protocols. I will not talk about these protocols. The thing to understand about why is it so complicated? Really, you can only understand why cryptographic protocols are complicated and why, and even cryptographic primitives, why they're complicated, by understanding the attacks they are subject to. And that's the one lesson you should always remember about cryptography.
Don't do your own crypto. You don't know what you're doing. You think, oh, look, that looks great. I know I've said that before. I'll just say it again. Don't do your own crypto. And that includes, don't even try implementing it yourself. Because even if you have the perfect algorithms, the implementation of them is subtle enough that you can mess it up in all kinds of ways. So, don't do it. Use something that someone else will put. The number of attacks they have to think about is just insane. But really, from a system security perspective, I do care about people messing with the communications, but that's really not quite the system's part of things. Normally, we're concerned more with what's in the box. And so the most common use case you draw on the individual system is files, file systems. When people talk about whole disk encryption, they're really talking about file system level encryption. So you have a laptop, you have a portable hard drive, you're walking around with it, you're afraid you're gonna lose it. Someone else, you don't want someone to be able to take your machine and just change everything on it. You use encryption. Or maybe you have individual files on your system, you encrypt those. And you might say, well, isn't file encryption enough for this? Right. You can encrypt a file and then send it. And if you send the file, if you encrypt and authenticate the file properly, you don't necessarily care about how it's transported. But most of the time, you just might as well just protect it in life because someone on the other side probably has to do something with the file. So they have to decrypt it anyway. So would you buy by just encrypting it separately here? Either this thing is going to keep you safe or it's not. But that's really against, this is against an adversary who gets access to your hardware. But there's another place in modern systems where crypto is actually important from a system security point of view, and to understand why, we'll talk about it in a bit more depth. But what is the other big use of crypto on individual boxes?
DRM.
Digital rights management, but it's actually it's the same technology, but the mandate is a little broader because it's about trusted software. Now, of course, this notion of trusted software bugs me. It's trusted in the sense of, if the software is compromised, you're dead. So, yes, you have to, when you say something's trusted, you're saying, if it betrays me, I'm in trouble. But there's this notion of that we can make sure the software is good by authenticating it and making sure it isn't tampered with. Notice there's not really any scope here for confidentiality, normally in this, it's more about making sure no one's messed with the bits. So the most common form of this is it's normally under the trusted boot, which really means your bootloader is using cryptography to make sure that the software that you're running has not been messed with. Now, to anchor this properly, you have to have something that you trust. Basically, whatever is going to implement your cryptography and hold your keys better be trustworthy. Where does the trust bottom out for a trusted boot? Have you heard of these things? TPMs? How many of you have heard of TPMs? Okay, some of you. So the idea of a TPM, Trusted Platform Module, is it's a secure coprocessor. That is, this is a chip, or a portion of the chip, on modern systems on a chip, it's a portion of the chip, that's meant to hold secrets in a way that they're, you know, others can't get at them, and do computations on those secrets. The idea is that the secret stays in there and never leaves, and it's the one doing certain cryptographic operations. So as long as TPM stays secure, the rest of your stack is secure. You have a chain of trust. And the typical way this chain of trust works is the TPM will make sure that the initial bootloader is properly signed and everything, and then it and the bootloader will then verify every other piece of software that's running. So by the time a full operating system is booted, every piece that is running, ideally from the applications on down, to the initial boot and the drivers and everything, has been cryptographically verified. So that an attacker, in order to break the system, either has to do one of two things. Either they have to break the TPM, let's do one, three things. Break the TPM, break the crypto, or get the keys. Now, getting the keys part normally is considered to be infeasible because, well, the keys are embedded in here. Except for one thing. What's the real thing this TPM is enforcing? It's saying that the software came from a trusted source. So it's saying that, oh, Microsoft or Ubuntu or Apple has signed this software. How does the TPM know that Apple signed the software? Because it has the public key of Apple. So you can break into the TPM and kind of compromise its functionality. You can break the cryptography that's verifying all this, or you could go to Apple and get their key. I personally think Apple keeping their key safe is probably actually the weakest link in this chain, because Apple has to sign their software all the time. How many people have access to the ability to create signed binaries inside their organization? Same thing with Microsoft, same thing with any Linux distribution. How many people have access to those keys? It might not be a huge number, but it's probably more than one. And if you could trick them into signing something, then you can compromise the entire trust of the system. Now, just because the software has been properly signed, does that mean the software is trustworthy? Not at all. Because you can always, what if the software has vulnerabilities? What if it has a little secret feature that's been added to the software? A backdoor, that special magic password that you type in Joshua and you're in past all the security. That's always possible. So the way I like to think about this is, if I see my best friend walking down the hall towards me, I've authenticated them, right? I've authenticated him. I should go up and shake his hand, right? I've authenticated him. But my best friend is walking down the hall carrying a bloody axe and has a murderous gleam in his eye. I've authenticated him. I know exactly who it is. Do I go up and shake his hand? Probably not. Probably do something different. But we don't have that concept, really, in most of the way we talk about security. That's just not there. There's a difference between authenticating something and it being safe. And we have this implicit notion, oh, it came from Microsoft, so it's safe. Or it came from somewhere else, so it's safe. But we see every day where software that is kind of a safe source is weaponized in some way. So I don't know if you all saw on Slack or something, the Malwarebytes discussion. So turns out Malwarebytes put out, so they're an anti-malware vendor, they put out two bad updates. Not just one, they put out one, and then the second one was also bad, which basically caused all their client systems essentially to shut down because it was a denial of service effectively. It was trusted software.
but it went wacko. So I'm just pointing this out just to show where the limitations of this is. So this trusted boot for a long time has gotten a lot of bad press. It's really a neutral technology, but it can be used for very bad things as well as for good things. I mean, it's fundamentally a tool of control. And the question is, who has control? Like, for example, on modern PCs, you can install keys in your BIOS which says which operating systems are trusted. Now you might go, well, I haven't had to install keys, but I've installed alternative operating systems on my computers. Why does that work? Because Microsoft signed the bootloader. How did Microsoft sign the boot? Wait, what? I installed Linux. You say Microsoft signed my Linux bootloader? Yep. For ease of use. I mean, because, you know, Microsoft knows if they start, you know, really trying to enforce protections on it, then they'll get in trouble. So technically Microsoft can lock down whatever is booted on your PC, although almost all BIOSes I've seen have the ability to load in separate keys. But it's not so simple, and certainly not easy for regular users. But there is a capability there. But in practice, that doesn't have to be used so much because people give bootloaders that are just generally signed by Microsoft. So you can actually use that secure boot infrastructure even if you're running an alternative operating system. But what if Microsoft decided not to sign the keys of other operating system vendors? Or what if, and if you couldn't install your own keys? What platform, what does that look like? Oh, that's iOS. There's no, iOS is running, iOS is basically Mac OS, at the lower levels. And there's no reason you couldn't run Linux on an iPhone in terms of hardware. Except that this prevents you. iOS software is all cryptographically signed, and there's a whole chain of trust going down to the lowest levels. And you have to break that. Do things. And Apple does not give out their keys. We'll talk more about what this means later in terms of jailbreaks, but basically, in order to install software that isn't approved by Apple on an Apple device, you have to find software vulnerabilities. And they have been locking down the platform. Now you might say, well, because they maintain control, that actually prevents bad things from happening on the hardware. But it also, and that's potentially a reasonable thing for most people. But it is a loss of control of your computer. It means ultimately you do not have say of what software runs on your computer. And you say, well, did you ever really have complete say? But this is a real technical mechanism that prevents things. But they say, well, we have to do that so that we prevent malware from being installed on your phone. And if you look at the Android world, you can see what the other side of that coin looks like. And it's not a pretty sight. All kinds of bad software runs on Android devices, and nowhere near that much badness is on iPhones. Now there's other reasons, when we talk more about Android security and their models, there's other reasons for saying that Android has issues, but it's part of it. So there's a trade-off. If you get flexibility to be able to run whatever software you want on your computer, that also doesn't mean the attackers can run whatever software they want on your computer. But if you lock it down, then you're saying, well, you have to have the keys to the kingdom before you can get access. So again, crypto is going to protect you in communications, it's going to protect from grabbing the hardware and looking at it, and going to protect, help verify software from the software that first starts on the system. So the basic primitives that are used for this are, there's cryptographic hashes, legal signatures and we'll just see. Broad categories. So if you do not have any background with these concepts, so these are kind of like, I don't know exactly what these are, you probably should go read up some on them. I will tell you the basics of it, but you may want to go read some. This is where things like block cipher, AES, digital signatures, RSA, cryptographic block ciphers. These two are often implemented using the same algorithms, but they are really different things, and actually their algorithms are specialized to one or the other. So RSA can be used for both digital signatures and public key encryption. There's algorithms like DSA, which is only digital signatures. Block ciphers is classically the old ones, DES, and now AES, and then Blowfish, and TwoFish. There's all kinds of block ciphers. Cryptographic hashes, this is only taught. MD5, SHA-1, SHA-2, SHA-256, that's what they're talking about here. These are all, there's a lot of similarity in what they are, what are they buying you? I mean, block cipher is, I have a secret key, I want to encrypt things. But the main thing, it's symmetric, so I require the exact same key to encrypt as to decrypt. A public key encryption, you have a public key and you have a private key. You give everyone else your public key, you hold on to your private key, you process documents with your private key to encrypt it, and then, everyone else can send you an encrypted document by encrypting it with your public key, and they send it to you, and you can decrypt it with your private key. So that's how anyone can, so if I want to send it, anyone wants to send me a secret message, they need my public key. So then they can take my public key from my website, encrypt it, and send it to you. Digital signatures, you invert it. I can create a signature using my private key, and anyone can verify it using my public key. So public key encryption, you start with your, you start with the private key and then go to the public key. Digital signatures, you start with the, the public key encryption, you start with the public key and go to the private key. Digital signatures, you start with the private key and go to the public key. Because this is letting the world verify versus letting the world send you a secret message. And then cryptographic hashes are all about creating a code that represents a set of information, a document, you can say, that can't be faked. Means that if you have a document that matches that bit pattern, then you have the document with high confidence. And the document hasn't been messed with. So there's a complex interplay. I can spend a few lectures talking about this. I really would prefer not to, because that's really proper cryptography, and there's lots of online resources about this. One thing is we could set up a post. One thing that I wanted you all to use Slack for is if you find like, oh, that concept wasn't very clear, I found this resource that really made it clear, post that. Help each other out. That's share resources. I can find all kinds of things to do it, but honestly, all I'm going to do is do a search. And the things that I find as good resources are not necessarily the ones that you all find as good resources. So help each other out. And if you can't find a good resource for something, then I'm happy to post things. But I'm not interested in crypto so much on this level. I'm interested more on what can I do with it. What does it buy me and what does it not buy me? And in this realm, you're really talking about who has the keys. All cryptography, at the end of the day, succeeds or fails based on key management. Who has the keys? Where did you get the keys? How do you know you have the right keys? Public key cryptography was this huge advance because it allowed
make key management much, much simpler. Before, if you do key management with the block cipher, really it's like, okay, how am I going to send you a secret message? Well, first we'll meet in a back alley and exchange pieces of paper with our, you know, with our secrets. The secret password is flowers. It's like, okay, secret password. So now you can use that later when you send messages. You use that to, that, okay, can the attacker try flowers as your code? Maybe, but should be something harder to guess than that. But with, but you had to have some sort of rendezvous in order to exchange keys beforehand, or by a separate channel. With public key encryption, you publish them. So confidentiality is an issue. You don't have to make sure no one overhears you in the alley. You can put them up on billboards, your public keys, because your pub, but now you have this problem of binding a key to an identity, which is, if I go on the internet and I find a public key that, you know, I just kind of search around and I find a public key. Oh, this is the public key of Justin Trudeau. And so now I can send a secret message to the Prime Minister and no one else will be able to read it. How do you know you got the right key? I can sit there on my computer and generate a key that says it's from anyone and post it on, you know, somewhere on the web, and then, you know, how do you know you got the right key? You don't. How we actually verify keys today is horrible. Utterly horrible. The most common schemes. Right? Well, one scheme, well, at the end of the day, the schemes are all, they're built into the software that you got. Your software typically comes with some keys that it trusts out of the box. The developer of the software determined that. So, for example, your iPhone, how does it know, or your Android device, how does it know who to trust? It's that it has the keys of Apple or Google or whatever built into the device. And so that's how it knows if that's the right thing. Now you might say, well, I visit websites all the time and I get this little lock icon, which is supposed to be secure. Well, it's doing TLS. But the trust anchor are the keys that the browser included, which are the keys of certificate authorities. How do you know the how are the certificate authorities vouching for all these millions of websites? Badly. Can I get a certificate that says from Microsoft or from Google? Anyone would see it and say, oh, look, this is from google.com. Oh, it looks great. You're not supposed to be able to do that, but you can. It happens all the time. And they have to revoke. And then, yeah. Again, that's a whole other topic we can talk about how you can lock that down. I just wanted to say that. Trusting, how you decide which keys to trust is a really big problem and is not at all a solved problem. And that undermines all the guarantees of crypto. If you really want to be sure about who you're communicating with or where you got something from, you check the keys manually. That's the only way really to be sure. Is that your key? If you haven't done that manual check, So if you're doing anything like secure communication or something, yeah. Depends on how much it's worth, depends how much you think the attacker's gonna mess with you, but at the end of the day, that's the problem there. So when I talk about crypto, but I said something about don't implement your own cryptography. And that really comes down to a more fundamental issue, which is how do you trust software?
How do you know that software is going to do what you think it's going to do? This matters in cryptography, but it matters all over the place. Any system you build for doing access control, for permissions, for defining your abstractions, your operating system, if it messes up, you're in trouble. So how do you make sure the software does what it thinks, what you think it should do? Well, how do we do it normally? What's a normal strategy?
QA and testing.
Yeah. The normal way is to test it. Right? We test the software, you've tested it well, okay, it seems to meet its functional requirements, we're great. That doesn't really cut it when you talk about security. But why not? There's something about the testing paradigm that's fundamentally wrong when you talk about trying to get security properties.
Well, usually it's the people who've written the software or doing the testing, so it makes it hard to see any mistakes.
So, well, okay, the developers testing the software, certainly that means they won't get all the bugs because they've got a certain mindset, and, you know, that's part of the problem. But it's worse.
Is it because you're only testing against known problems, not testing for the unknown?
Well, most software testing is testing for functional properties. So, does the software do X? To test for security properties, you have to make sure it does not do Y. It's all about proving a negative. And yeah, you can have tests for saying, well, we know we encountered this problem, so we'll put a test in to counter this problem. But what about all the other problems you don't know about? You haven't tested for them. So how do you know? How can you have any guarantees? And the fact is, you can't. So it's not to say you don't want to test software. But if someone says, the software has passed all its tests, thus I trust it, you go, no. No, it hasn't. What's considered to be the ultimate in trust in software? What's the ultimate way to trust software?
Pay people to break it?
No. Although, I mean, so if you pay some people to break software, so that's called red teaming. You go there, they break it. You fix what they broke. Is it fixed?
No.
You fix what they broke. That doesn't mean it's all. You know, it doesn't mean you try bringing them in again, we'll find other problems.
I think more like bug bounties, where like Apple will pay you a lot of money if you can get deep into their system.
So
you can kind of trust that their system is not easy to get into because they won't give you $500,000 if you can't.
Right. But does that mean no one's sitting on vulnerabilities, exploits that can get into iOS?
It means you trust it more than BlackBerry.
Maybe. So bug bounties are all about putting economic incentives. It's about turning the normal black market and vulnerabilities into an open market. It's saying that, okay, you might be able to get this much money on the black market for that exploit. Well, instead, give it to the folks who actually fix it, and you'll still get some money for it. So it's a way of going legit for these security researchers. But again, it's not like these guys are ever unemployed. The ones who are finding vulnerabilities, they can always find vulnerabilities. It may take more effort, take more time, but it's not like we've gotten to the point where, oh wow, no one's ever found a vulnerability now in the software, we must be done. Because that's really what it is. If software was really secure, you'd say, go for it, I don't care how much money you have. You can't find anything wrong with this. There are no vulnerabilities to find. So, proper way to make trusted software in the classic security vein is with formal verification. In other words, you prove your software is correct. Because if it's a mathematical proof, I mean, that's, in some sense, fundamental mathematical truth. Your program now is a mathematical truth. How do you get better than that? Now, of course, when we say formal verification, verifying with respect to what? Means you have your specification. Which has been transformed into code. So what you're really verifying is this, is the transformation. It's saying you start with this specification of functional properties, of security properties. This is a formal specification of how your code should be, and that if you can prove your code to be correct, it really means your code follows the specification.
Mm-hmm. I don't really understand how you can formally prove security besides for cryptography.
Oh, no. You can formally prove things. So what it is you have to make your specification be for things like, and your access control system. If you formally verify the software, you could say that it only allow someone in who knows the password for a user account. And actually, you wouldn't even necessarily need cryptography to verify. All the cryptography does in hashing a password is to prevent if someone steals your disk or steals a password file. It doesn't actually matter in terms of verifying the password. It could just be stored in plain text from the perspective of someone getting in by the front door. So you're getting at an idea that is very important, which is, how do I know I have the right specification? It's one thing to have a formal specification for functional characteristics. Another thing to have a formal specification that includes all the security properties I want. Because the trouble is attackers keep coming with new ways of attacking systems. And if your specification model does not include those properties, you have no way of verifying that the code has those properties. Now, formal verification is very hard. There has been increasing efforts to scale up formal verification. People have made microkernels and things that are formally verified by pretty good things. People have made a lot of advances in this. I don't have a lot of hope for this being useful for anything except the smallest portion of our software base, simply because this is fundamentally hard. How often do you go around going, making code with very specific formal specifications? And have you tried developing with specifications, like really precise specifications that implement them? It's hard. It's really hard. It's a lot of work. It's actually much harder than actually writing the code. Order of magnitude. Now, one reason why functional programming is potentially a very nice thing from a security perspective, because functional programming a lot of times will be, you have to think in a much more mathematical way. And there are even programming languages, functional programming environments, where you have to prove your code is correct. That the compiler has a built-in theorem prover, so that you have to put all these assertions in. If you haven't thought through all the cases, your code doesn't have a correct proof, and it won't even compile. So if you get it past the compiler, you actually do have a correct program. But again, those are very much harder tools to use. Now, I'm not saying, maybe we would go towards certain classes of software will be made with these sort of tools. Great. But I don't think at the end of the day that will solve all the security problems for reasons that I'll explain as we go.
What type of incentive is there for developing code that way? I mean, mainly doesn't code, if people are...
Add an order of magnitude to your costs, your development costs?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's...
And users don't really see it, right?
Well, the reason you would do this is because you had incentive. So, like, the places people really are thinking of things like are safety critical systems. Like, if you're putting software in a pacemaker, you might want to make sure it doesn't kill them. And how do you make sure it doesn't kill them? You know, testing is pretty good, but how are you going to test it? If you have formal specification that gives you some... If you do formal verification, you have stronger guarantees. It's not to say that you have everything perfect, because of course, you know, your specification is transferred to code, you have to make sure this transformation is there, but then of course this code runs on real systems. And any sort of formal verification stuff is assuming an abstraction of the system. And if your model doesn't take into account certain properties of the system, all your guarantees are gone. So you'll have to make assumptions about how the processor works. Modern processors are incredibly complicated. And then they have bugs, like those Spectre meltdown things. You know, it's like, if there's bugs in the processor, it's not implementing the specification properly itself. So then how can your code running on it actually follow the specification? So I personally think formal verification is a useful tool. For very high value code, it's a useful thing to do, but don't ever fool yourself that you're gonna, even with this, you're not gonna get rid of all the attack avenues. To give you an idea of how hard it actually is in practice, have you heard about the, so there's a famous thought experiment, which I don't know anyone's actually done, but let's say you're building, say, the login program, or SSH. You know, so let's say you're building SSH daemon. You look at the source code of SSH, and you see there's no backdoors. What makes you sure that the binary doesn't have any backdoors? How do you know the compiler didn't modify the code as it was compiling and inserted a backdoor into the binary that's not present in the source code? How do you know? And the fact is you don't know. I'm trying to remember who gave the talk. It's this based from a famous old talk on trusting trust. I think it's what it's called. I'll post a link if I can remember it. But yeah, how do you know that the code that transformed your program is trustworthy? You don't. It could do all kinds of transformation, including sticking in a little back door, so now anyone with the, you know, typing an abracadabra can get into your box. And it's not in your source code. So when you were to do this proper verification, you really had to verify your entire tool chain. You might say, well, you know, I just use this tool to inspect it. And you're like, well, how could that tool be modified so you can't see the changes to the compiler? Or so you can't see the thing that's modified. I mean, it's just everything you use to try to introspect on things tends to be a program. And for a sophisticated enough attacker, why can't they make it so you can't see the changes that are made? We see these kind of issues in real life in systems like rootkits. So a rootkit is, we should have a lecture on rootkits later, but a rootkit is just someone has compromised your operating system, typically at the lowest level. Modified your kernel, but also modified user line binary, so as to change your view of what's happening. Now you can't see certain processes run. System calls don't run the way you expect. Arbitrary properties of the system have been changed. So let's say a Bitcoin miner is running in the background and you can't see it, let alone terminate it. In general, if an operating system has been infected by a rootkit, the only sure way to clean it up is to erase it, start over. And what's really bad nowadays is we're starting to get to the point of having things that don't just compromise your operating system, but compromise your firmware. So they compromise your, it's not just your BIOS anymore, it's your EFI. the initial boot source. Now all the stuff about trusted boot, that all goes out the window. What do you do with a system that's been compromised that way? Well, maybe you can reflash it. Maybe, although oftentimes you're relying on the tools that are hosted from it, and it just might just pretend to reflash it and not do anything, because the system has to flash itself. The other thing you do is you go to the motherboard and take out the chip and put in a new chip. If there's a chip to take out and put back in, is it integrated to other things? So in other words, basically, you've got a doorstop. Systems that have been compromised that sort of low level, you just have to throw out. Then what if they've been compromised at the factory? This is what folks, if you ever see defense people worry about foreign power, like, wow, all of our electronics are manufactured in China, and we don't trust China. Huh. And we're putting this in our planes and submarines and the, huh. Yeah. Not to say there aren't defenses, but it's not such an easy... Could someone close the door for this? It's not such an easy problem. Trust is hard. And the sophistication of the attacks that are possible is always more than you assume. You're like, how could someone do that? That would be way too hard. If you ever think that would be way too hard, stop yourself. Because people do ridiculously hard things all the time. So, on the DRM front, going back to that thread, there is a piece of this that is related, but not quite the same as the crypto stuff. But it's related to this idea of trusted software. What if you're running software? You are distributing an application. Your application needs to be able to run in environments where you don't trust the computer that it's running on. Anyone know a common scenario for this? You have to run an application on a system that you do not trust, and you have to make sure it doesn't do bad things. There's one scenario that I know most of you have experience with.
Do online banking on any sort of computer or something?
Online banking, yes. Although most of online banking actually doesn't really protect much against it in practice. I mean, in the sense of you don't necessarily trust the computer that it's on, but actually their implementation, they kind of have to. And they say if you don't trust it, okay, your money gets stolen. Okay, maybe you're insured, maybe you're not. And that's how they deal with it. They don't really deal with it in a technical fashion. They do some crypto and things, but you know, they're not the forefront. Who has to worry about applications running on a system that the application developer does not trust, yet they still need it to run and maintain the integrity of their code? Multiplayer games, online games. How do you prevent cheating? How do you prevent someone from cheating? You know, you thought, well, why don't you just put all the logic and stuff on the server? Well, they try to do that, but actually for performance reasons, they need to have a lot of that code running on the client. Otherwise, they just have a bad game. They have so much information on the client that if the player could get all the access to all the information the client had, they could cheat like crazy. Like, for example, think in a first-person shooter, like, oh, there's a wall there, so you can't see through it. Well, the game engine knows what's behind that wall. Wouldn't it be nice to see through that wall? Very helpful. You know, someone's hiding right behind them. You just go around the corner and shoot them. Very helpful. So, how do you prevent that? Because you're distributing an application, a game, that's going to run on a player's computer. How do you trust that computer? Well, one way you trust it is by making a console-only game. What's the advantage of consoles? Trusted boot. They've been locked down really hard. You're not supposed to run arbitrary applications. Everything's supposed to be signed. They've got all this stuff on there for prevent me. This is the argument that game console makers often make about why they have so much stuff to prevent pirated software. It's not really about stopping piracy. We just have to prevent people from cheating. But that's actually true. You look at the games that people cheat a lot with online, it's like it's much more common on PC-based games than it is on console games. Because consoles are locked down. And in fact, the console owners will often do elaborate steps to say, okay, now, we know this one's been compromised, now you can only run the game with a newer version of our software. If you don't update, you can't access any online features. You've seen that with modern consoles. And they require updates all the time. They're keeping their trusted boot locked down. That's what whole effort is. On a PC, modern versions of Windows, when they have trusted boot, they can implement some degree of this. But Windows has limitations because it's still a relatively open platform. They run a lot of other random software. So how else can a developer protect their software if not for trusted boot?
By scanning the system.
So you can so one way is an anti-cheat system. So anti-cheat systems really are just custom anti-malware detectors. But they define malware as the cheat software, and they've just say, by agreeing to install their software, you're also installing their antivirus. Right? It's a custom thing. Just scanning your entire system, watching memory, and trying to stop that. That can help some.
Mm-hmm. You cyclic redundancy check on the software.
Ah. So first of all, a CRC, it provides no protection at all. What you're talking about, that's a hash. That's not a cryptographically secure hash. It's very easy to fake a CRC check. But a cryptographically secure hash, maybe. That provides some benefits. But what you really want is you want tamper-resistant software. Now, tamper-resistant software often uses things borrowed from cryptography. Algorithms, mechanisms, principles, and stuff. But it's not really doing crypto. Maybe the hash stuff. More what this tends to be doing is obfuscation. Why do I say it's obfuscation as opposed to classic cryptography? It's because where is the key? So you think of the code is encrypted, but the code has to run. So who decrypts the code? The code itself. So the thing you want to protect and its key are in the same place? That's not crypto. Because yeah, that's just not crypto. What you've all you're really doing is trying to make software so it's hard to reverse engineer. You don't want to make it easy for someone to figure out how the code works. Because if they can figure out how the code works, they can then make modifications to it and make it work the way the attacker wants as opposed to the way the developer wants. So this is the classic, you know, copy protection software would often include includes tamper-resistant mechanisms because, of course, the thing to prevent you from making copies, why not just remove it? If you just remove that code, then the thing will work profitable. You have to have another part of the system actually watch it and kind of go, like, well, has the software been tampered with? This is a very hard problem to make tamper-resistant software. Obfuscation is hard to do. There's actually in Ottawa, we actually have some world-leading people who do this. There's a company that formerly was known as Cloakware that now was bought by a company called Irdeto, which sells tools for this. They classically sell a lot to the set-top box market. So set-top boxes for downloading, cable TV and premium channels on cable TV or satellite TV. They don't want that software to be compromised so that people can then get channels for free, and so people want to obfuscate their software. But lots of other folks who want to make sure their software isn't messed with, they'll try using their special compilers, which just scramble up the code in ways that make it very, very hard to reverse engineer. Now, here's a fun piece of this. So, one strategy you can use for this sort of thing is, why can't you have the program checksum itself? Right? So, you can compute cryptographic hashes. Why don't we compute cryptographic hashes of the program itself as it runs? So it constantly says, has the code been modified as the code has been running? Seems kind of cool, right? You just hash as you go and you verify that memory is the way you expect it to be. Turns out you can defeat that on a modern system in a rather annoying way. Anyone know why? I'm not expecting you to, I'm just curious about it, because this is actually the basis of a research paper that I co-authored years ago. This guy, Glenn Worster, it was Glenn Worster's work. He's now at BlackBerry. Smart guy. In an operating system, when you have memory, so let's say you have the program in memory here. So you have some pages in memory. Classic operating systems apply, operating system nowadays apply permissions to memory. Right? So some of this memory might be read-only. This other memory might be read-write. Actually, the classic thing is normally read-only, not normally read-only, normally read-execute. So the code in memory will be read-execute, and the data will be read-write. Because you don't, and often these are split because these prevent certain class of attacks.
I guess that's how you do it.
Right.
Could you have your cryptographically secure code which will verify that when it comes time to run, you just swap up?
That's exactly it. And so what it is that you have some code that's executable and readable. And some code is read-write, but this code, so the code is readable and executable. What do we have to do the checksumming? We have to read it. What do we have to do to execute it? We have to have execute permissions. Those are separate permissions. So what you do is you make the code so it's either in read mode or in execute mode. And so when you run the code, you have an execute mode, and you put the modified code in. But when it actually tries reading it, you switch out and put the unmodified code in for when it does a read. So when it does a read, it gets the unmodified code, so the checksum checks out, but when it's actually executing, it's executing modified code. Because those are two separate things, and the operating system knows when you're reading versus executing, and you can make a trap.
Mm-hmm. It's not really hard to do in terms of programming, because then you'd have to write in assembly or something. Because you're modifying the hardware.
Glenn, when he was doing this, had to modify some low-level page replacement algorithms. So yeah. This is not, you're messing with, in order to implement this attack, you have to mess with the kernel. And you have to change how its memory management works.
That's only hard for the first guy.
Exactly. This is the thing about attacks. It's hard for the guy who implements it, but then you make a little packet and you distribute it. Now anyone can do this.
You're saying that you have it when it's in read mode, you leave the unmodified code, and then when it's in execute, you swap it for modified code. But since it's read, execute, it's not write.
No, see, but see, no. But read, these are just permission bits. The kernel can do whatever it wants with the memory.
Oh, okay.
So it just has two versions of the program in memory and just swaps between them. Because remember, part of our assumption is we don't trust the OS. So this is saying, if you don't trust the OS, but you're running on the OS, can mess with you in this sort of way. So that's, yeah. So this is, so you, in order to really do this, I mean, you might, not saying you don't want to do that, but you have to do more than just do checksumming tamper resistance. You really have to obfuscate the code. You have to do lots of weird, and the transformations that they do to obfuscate it are really messy. It's, again, that's, that can be a whole course of material, how you transform code. But it's, I mean, think of it this way. It's just trying to make it a puzzle. It's like, how do I make the ultimate spaghetti code? How do I make it so I can't follow the logic?
I once got sent a virus or whatever, some malware in a JavaScript file by email.
Mm-hmm.
And so I opened it up, and I was trying to figure out how, what it was doing.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just a fun exercise to, like, go through slowly and feel like the way it was messing with strings to create functions and stuff. And I spent like half an hour and said, that's just going to take too long to figure out what it's doing.
So that gives another example. Where else do we really see obfuscated code? You see it on the web. All the time. Why do we see obfuscated code on the web all the time? Very heavily obfuscated. So it's all visible. So one thing JavaScript has a disadvantage is classically you're downloading the source code of the program. But why do they, I mean, it's one thing to say, what's the attack they're trying to prevent? That's what I'm saying. It's like, okay, you're downloading the code. Why do I care?
Ad blockers.
Ah.
They don't want
to. So ad blockers are part of it, but that's actually not the main thing. That's part of it. It's kind of increasingly important. So you want to prevent people from blocking the ads so they make it hard for you to understand the code, so you can't do that. But actually, there's lots of ways of doing ad blockers that are much simpler. But there's a much more important category of attack.
Reusing their code?
No. Click fraud. Click fraud is the really big reason why code on the web is so what is click fraud? It's, can I automate someone pretending to visit pages and clicking on advertisements? I mean, think about it. You know, I make my website, I put some ads on it, and then I just have a bunch of bots go and click, 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 click away, and cha-ching, I've got money. This is a big problem. Advertisers are defrauded all the time by this. So to try and prevent this, that's why JavaScript is so, on the web, is just so nasty. It's really nasty code. Because, I mean, the big thing is they're worried about clickjacking. But that means that because they're so worried about that, it's normal for code on the web to be ridiculously obfuscated. So how do you tell the difference between that and actually malicious code? You can't. I mean, like I say, I just don't want to run any JavaScript. That's really weird. If you do that, you basically don't run any JavaScript. Except for like basic applications or something. But I mean, otherwise, you know, so much of the web depends upon this.
Is that sort of how CAPTCHAs function?
CAPTCHAs are different. CAPTCHAs are part of the anti-bot. It's part of protecting against clickjacking, basically, by trying to make sure humans are in the loop. So if they think that someone is, a non-human is trying to do something, they put the CAPTCHA up to say, okay, can you solve the CAPTCHA? Then we think you're human. Of course, then they make better algorithms for doing the CAPTCHA problems and break that. Arms race. So, I just wanted to bring this up here as obfuscation is the defense you use when you're running code on a system that you don't trust. And there are very many common examples, online games and the web, where code is running all the time on systems that are not trusted. And but this is not proper cryptography because the key is in the code. It's not like you've encrypted the code and then separately got the key. You had to put both in there because you had to download it and run it on the platform. What you're trying to prevent is someone from reverse engineering your code and figuring out its semantics so they can make modifications.
Could you just give me an example of a method used to obfuscate? Like, so how can you change the structure of code but still allow it to run and do what it's designed to do?
You do all the things you're taught not to do. So you know how you have things like you separate functions apart and they only this operation happens in this function, this operation on this function, they're different things? Mix them up. Put everything in one giant function. Put the code, mix together unrelated functionalities in there. Change all your variable names. Make your data structures ridiculously organized. Like, for example, you might want, you have like four different objects, merge them all into one, or merge them into two, or make the information you want from one object into another object. Make your code flow go, let's go here. We'll make a jump over here, and then jump to here, and then jump to here, and then jump to here. Think of the ways to make your code not, all the things you hate about making, ununderstandable code, just do that to the nth degree. The ill-one-duals will encrypt data values, so that when you operate on it, it'll actually be, when you think that's a string, no, it's not, that string's actually been encrypted. And they'll put other strings in there that look like would be the strings you want, so you think you're going to do that, but actually the real string you want has been obfuscated, so it just looks like random binary data. Or there's multiple copies of it.
What if you use, for the same code, it was like a wrapper around the simple code, and then it was like the spaghetti wrapper?
Spaghetti?
Yeah.
Oh, no, there's, it's a whole kind of, how you, what time is it now? It's 11:12. Okay. There's all kinds of ways of doing code obfuscation.
But would it make it not work if there's like really understandable code inside the wrapper?
Are you talking about a way of defeating obfuscation?
Like you have a functional game, and then you're like, okay, it's done. And now I want to make it not hackable, and then you just put a surrounding.
No, there's all kinds of ways of doing this. There's no way to make it unbreakable. Because at the end of the day, the code always has to be understandable in some sense to one thing, which is the processor or the runtime environment. It has to be run. The code has to be run. It has to be understood, in a sense, because it's executing by the hardware. So you have this weird thing, and you want to make it so it still runs, still does the stuff by the processor, or by the runtime environment, but yet a human can't figure out how it did it, even using all kinds of fancy tools to reverse engineer. So this is, it's a fun game. I mean, if you're interested in amazing, it's like cryptography, it's this back and forth thing. But I find it more interesting from obfuscated code. I see as fundamentally dangerous. Because if it's obfuscated, now I can't figure out how the code's working. I can't figure out what it's doing. So I've lost all transparency. So now the only solution I have is to rely on my trusting whoever gave me the code.
Also, isn't going to take them longer to put out updates when it does get cracked?
Well, oftentimes the obfuscation is imposed by automated tools. So they have the original source code. They make the modifications out, and they just run it through the tool, and they're done. So it's not really, but it's more that it's just a... it violates the security principle. You would really like to be able to watch things as they run to make sure they're doing the right thing, and now you can't do that. So I find whenever looking at systems and you go, why do I require obfuscation here? I tend to see systems that have obfuscation like that are inherently untrustworthy. So like iOS, they have lots of locking things down with the trusted platform module stuff, but it's not obfuscated as far as I know. I actually don't know. But they aren't fundamentally relying on obfuscation. That's not their main defense. They may have added obfuscation layers afterwards. But they're really relying on cryptographic things and saying, okay, this has been signed, we've got our TPM, we've locked it all down. So you can't. And then they're making sure their software doesn't have vulnerabilities. Why do we have to rely on the web having obfuscated code? It's because of a revenue model. It's an economic model. And that implies something that's like, that revenue model, in a sense, is fundamentally opposed to security. If you're going, because what do we want to do now? We want to visit arbitrary websites and we want to download code for them to make the websites run. At the very least, I'd like to be able to see that code that runs in my system to be able to make sure it's not doing bad things. That's kind of the ideal, you know, transparency. If your revenue model relies on things not being transparent, there's a conflict there. But that's often the case. Security and other factors are in conflict. We accept less security because we want other things. In this case, we want to be able to surf the web for free. We don't want to pay. We don't want to pay, someone has to pay, advertisers pay, and that's how we pay.
Application. I think that covers all the main points I want to talk about here. Any questions, pieces of this? So the, how many of you installed alternative firmwares on your phones, the Android phones? Really? That's it? How many of you run Android? And none of you run alternate ROMs. I'm kind of shocked.
I don't have one phone. I can't risk breaking it.
Really?
People used to run alternate ROMs all the time. I guess Android's gotten good enough, they just don't bother when it's gotten too hard.
There's a lot of manufacturers that already go with alternate ROMs. Like, I know OnePlus uses Oxygen.
Right.
And then obviously, like, Samsung, I think any time I've had a Samsung phone, I always replaced it, but a lot of the other manufacturers are going with, like,
right.
ROMs.
Yeah, but I've never come across something that I couldn't do.
Right, that's the fact is nowadays it's flexible enough, you don't need to install those other ones. But, you know, there's something that if you don't install your own OS, you don't quite know what software you're actually running. And you've all heard about the various Android phones that have compromised firmwares, which were phoning home and sending personal information, sending SMS messages or other things back to some random server or I'm not saying you definitely should, but I just found it very interesting that this is a group that obviously is interested in security, and very few of you have done that. It used to be a much more common thing. I understand why, but I'm still a little surprised.
Maybe we've given up the hope of actually having security. Accepted the world that we live in.
Android's bad. I trust iPhones much more than I trust Android devices, because it's just,
But
in general, isn't it a lot less safe to root your phone?
Well, not necessarily. I mean, it's a different threat model. I mean, it's a question of if you can. I mean, normally, if you can make sure that the OS you've installed in your system is trusted, I mean, that gives you a high level of assurance. If the OS gets compromised, yes, you're potentially screwed, and if you had trust down to the bootloader, you might be a little bit safer. But you're also then going, well, are you running a firmware that you trust?
And in particular, security updates. Is your phone getting regular security updates? You know, so that's a problem in the Android world. Anyway, many more things to talk about. Good luck on the assignment. If you have further questions, let me know. We'll post the Slack. I am happy to leak information. Let me know.